Our first guest this hour is an actress best known for her role as Nellie Olson on Little House on the Prairie. She's a stand-up comedian, activist, the author of a wonderful memoir entitled Confessions of a Prairie Bitch. We are thrilled to be joined this afternoon by Allison Arngrim. Allison, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You got some busy things happening in your life here. You've got a birthday coming up, an early happy birthday to you, and a trip to France, where we know from the book they absolutely love you.
It's true. They are. It's crazy. I mean, Little House on the Prairie has just, over the years, has become more and more popular all over the world. But the French, they love it, and I find they kind of like Nellie Olson best. I think they don't think she's mean. They think she's French.
Well, I was late, and I don't know why I was late to reading your book, because it came out a number of years ago, but I'm so glad I got to it. It was laugh out loud funny. It was poignant. It was inspiring in so many ways as well.
Oh, thank you. I'm so pleased. And that's something I've noticed. I go on Amazon, I'm like, some of these reviews are from last week. People are still buying it. They're still ordering Amazon whenever I go to an event or a show. And I had an edition come out in France, and even at the shows I'm doing in France, I have to have a stack of them on the table. People just can't get enough of it.
Well, I want to talk about your background. You've had a more than interesting life, and let's start at the beginning. Is it safe to say that your parents had a unique relationship?
I think, to put it mildly, I mean, that's the thing, as they used to say, we'd go to parties in the 70s and 80s, and they'd laugh and say, your parents invented parties like this. usually people of older parents think of them, people who married in the 50s, as being very stodgy, but no, and this is, they met back in the theater in Canada, but my father was openly bisexual to my mother. I don't think the neighbors knew in the 50s and 60s, but my mother did, and they thought this was just completely hunky-dory.
Your mom was an incredibly talented and successful voiceover artist, was the voice of Casper and Gumby, Sweet Polly Purebred, and I didn't know until reading the book she was also on the first family album with Maine native Von Meter.
Yes, that's right. He's from Maine. People remember this, the first family album. It's become iconic because the cover artwork, where it's photoshopped, that they're all standing in front of the White House. And you see this picture, and there's what appears to be a young woman with a balloon who obviously is doing the children's voices. That's my mom. She's like 40 in that picture, just, 22 or something. But, my mother was the voice of Caroline and John John on the album where Von Meter was portraying JFK. And there's actually, for a collector, two albums, the famous one, and there was First Family 2, where they had a lot of songs, they had parody songs and things. Unfortunately, it was released just a couple of weeks before the assassination, and so most people do not own a copy of the number 2 album.
One of the most difficult parts of the book to read, and obviously difficult for you to experience and write about, is the fact that you were assaulted for many years by your brother. Was it important for you to talk about that and get it out there in the world?
Yeah, because what I found out over the years I started talking about this is it is so common. I mean, when you talk to people who work in child abuse, they will tell you flat out that, unfortunately, the majority of abuse cases, sexual abuse cases, the victim knows the attacker, the abuser is known to the victim in 85-90% of the cases, and in the majority of cases, it's a family member. It's the father or the stepfather or the grandfather or the brother or the uncle. I actually had a defense attorney, during a radio show, we're on a show together, a defense attorney actually tell me that in 25 years of working in the defense, for people being tried for sexual abuse, he had never had a case where it wasn't the father.
Wow.
Now, that's a pretty horrifying and damning statement, but apparently this is it. And when I've started talking about having been abused, the number of people said they were abused by their brother or stepbrother, and they didn't know who to tell. They said, well, everyone talks about the father, stepfather, but it was my grandpa or it was my brother, and they didn't know who to tell. And families often leave their children with someone they trust. And they think, okay, I didn't hire a babysitter from outside. It was a close family friend. It's a relative. What could possibly go wrong? And unfortunately, most people who are sexually abused by a close family friend or relative.
And that makes the law that you helped overturn in California, all that more mind-boggling to me that under the provisions of this law, these child protection laws that you worked with the protect.org people to defeat, there was almost an exemption made for people who were close relatives and, what, even personal friends.
It's absolutely the craziest thing in the world, and it's in a lot of states. We knocked it out of about 7 states. We managed to change this law in California, New York, and several other states. But it's extremely common to have an exception made in the sexual abuse jail sentences for people who are related to the victim, which is crazy because it's not an exception the majority of time. It's going to be a relative. Or as they said, in the law, they actually coded this in the law, or someone living in the home like a family member. And I thought, good Lord, does that mean house guests, boarders? I mean, who are you including here? And in California, the most egregious offenses, I mean, all the worst stuff, continuous abuse, multiple victims, all of this was included. But then it would say, but a person could be eligible for probation with absolutely no time served and even deferred entry of judgment where they have no record. That person has no record after being convicted of multiple counts of sexual abuse, only because it's a relative. So we managed to change that in California and several other states, but it's still going on. It's a major problem. It's sort of deep-seated in the law that people are just, they're in such denial. There's people who don't want to believe that it's the relatives. And so people who are convicted sex offenders and their attorneys can swoop in and create these kind of loopholes in the law.
Well, when you decided to go public in a big way by sharing your story on Larry King, it may be my favorite moment of the book, the reaction of your dad when you told him.
Yes, because, well, as I said, my family, kind of nuts and very in show business. And my father, my manager, was so absolutely, his head was so completely into the publicity. There's a chapter about my father called The Publicity Seeking Missile. He was so obsessed with showbiz and publicity that when I called him to tell him I was going public on Larry King about being sexually abused, instead of being worried about what people would think or being, oh, my God, you poor thing, he went, oh, wait, you have the whole hour? Is it just you on Larry King? It's you. Who else is on? You're on for the whole hour? Oh, my God, I'm throwing a party. I need to call a caterer. He began discussing calling a caterer to have people in because he was so excited that, well, I was on CNN for an entire hour. This was a great coup. And I was like, you do understand what I just said I was going to be talking about. And he's like, yes, of course. Well, that's very, you should be doing that. Oh, my God, the whole hour. And it took him hours to come down from the sort of the ceiling of, this is an incredible press moment that she has gotten the hour to, oh my God, my daughter is telling this story.
We're talking with Allison Arngrim here on Downtown. So many wonderful stories about the making of A Little House on the Prairie and the people involved in that. I was very happy to learn what an incredible mensch Melissa Gilbert is.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, we got along like a house of fire. She's like my little sister, and she's a really cool person. It's funny because, you know, she wound up becoming president of the Screen Actors Guild, and I tell a story in the book. She was organizing the actors when she was 9 and 10 years old when, you know, the stage mothers would start rumors and try to pit the child actors against each other. She would call a meeting in her dressing room and have us all in and say, okay, we need to nip this in the bud right now. We have to stick together. And so when she wound up becoming an organizer for the Actors Union, well, that's not surprising.
You had a great response when people asked you, did you love Michael Landon? Did he love you? And you didn't talk about love. You talked about respect.
Yes. And that's so rare, and it's rare in Hollywood, and for child actors, it's unheard of. Very often child actors, you know, it's the nature of the business. Sometimes as a child, you're cast because you have the right color hair. They've hired 2 people to play the parents, and they want a kid who looks like them, and that the main factor in your getting the job is not necessarily your performance, but are you short, and do you look like the people who have been hired to play your parents? And that can be a little difficult. But they're often treated as props. And so a lot of child actors will tell you that they were treated like the furniture on the shows that they were on. It was very difficult for them. But on Little House, all of us found that we were treated with an enormous amount of respect, that we were held very accountable. We were expected to do the work and know our lines, and like a grown person, like, and, you know, we were treated as actors. And Well, I tell the story, but the guy, the assistant director, he wanted to hand out candy and gum to the kids at the end of the day, because we had so many children, with the atmosphere of the school kids, the extras. And he said, and Michael asked him to stop doing it, and said, no, no. He said, they don't need gum. They're actors. They get their paycheck at the end of the week, but they're not trained animals. And he said, and I don't want them doing that because it's not really respectful. They're not little trained dogs that you have to give a treat to. They're adults. They're like adults in that respect. They're actors, and I expect them to be doing their job because they're doing their job.
Melissa Sue Anderson was, this, I guess we'd say, a tough nut to crack. You tried. A lot of people tried. At the end of the book, you expressed hope that someday maybe she would come around. Has that happened?
Not completely, but you know, we had a cast reunion thing in, 2014 was our 40th reunion. We just had our 45th reunion. Crazy.
Wow.
45th anniversary. And our 40th reunion, a group of us were on the Today Show in New York. And we came in, and Melissa Sue Anderson, at the last minute, she's agreed to show up. We're sort of sure Melissa Sue Anderson is coming. And we said, well, what on earth? Some of us hadn't talked to her in ages. So what is this going to be like? And, you know, she was so nice. She was nice all day. And, of course, it's terrible to say, but we were sort of turning to each other after the first 2 hours and going, she's been nice for 2 hours. What's gotten into her? But I don't know if it's because she moved to Montreal. She's very happy with her husband. Maybe the pressure of show business. She didn't feel quite as pressured to be perfect and on all the time. I don't know. But that day, she seemed terribly relaxed and seemed very happy on the day of her 40th anniversary. So we said, there's hope! There's hope!
Allison, do you think the respect that you were talking about, that Michael Landon sort of showed to the child actors of the series, really helped with the success of a show that was so focused on the child's children as the story of the show?
Absolutely. I mean, people to this day, I mean, that's what I mean. 45 years? Who the heck's watching a show 45 years later? But there they are. I mean, it just blows my mind. 45 years later, and it's all over the world. And I ask people, you know, people in Sri Lanka and all over the world watching the show, I'm like, why are you in the Little House? It makes no sense. And I ask them, why? And they have this emotional bond with the show. And you wouldn't have that if the children's performances were overly canned or trite and not realistic. Mm-hmm. People would not have been sucked into it and be crying at every episode. There was something very real and very raw and emotional about a lot of the children's performances that made an impact, so it wasn't just the adults. If it was too fake, if the kids were just hitting their mark and saying a cute line, it would not have worked. And I think that's why all these years later, we have not only people going back and watching, but people weren't even born when this thing was on, and they're watching it now. They're watching it on, it's streaming on Amazon, and I'm just blown away every single day when I find out this is happening. But I think it is absolutely, it's the direction of Michael Landon, it's the performances, and it holds up.
Speaking of reaction, obviously a huge reaction to Nellie Olson. The first time you realized what that reaction might be, if I remember from the book, it was when you were going to school and somebody yelled at you from across the school grounds.
This is horrifying but true. I knew I was playing the villain, and once I got the role, I was like, oh, wow, this is crazy. Okay, I'm the villain. Well, this is all going to be a whole world here. And I always admired the villains in films, TV shows. So I thought, well, that'll be fun. And then I've, you know, shot the thing, and I had a good time doing it, and then I go to school, and I'm like, okay, now it has shown, it's been on TV, this is amazing. And as I said, I wasn't terribly popular in school, and so I thought, well, hey, now I'm on television, maybe this will help. And I walked on the grounds at 8 o'clock in the morning, and this girl screams as soon as I'm the only one on the grounds, and she yells from the top of the thing at me, you bitch! Oh, my God, what do? I go home? Do I just leave? Or do I? And I thought, well, I guess this is the beginning. I mean, this is how people are going to be. What do you do? And as I said in the book, it's absolutely true. At that second, it did dawn on me. I went, okay, this is what people are going to do. do I run? I mean, I could turn around and go home and call my parents and get a ride or so. Or do I, what do I do? Because how I react to this one, this is going to set the tone for the rest of the thing. And so I looked up at her and I said, thank you, and bowed. I took my curtain call. I was like, yes, ma'am. And I thought, that's it. I'm going to have to embrace this and run with it now. Or, you know, that's it. I'm chopped liver here.
Can you talk about what you call the Bette Midler school of overcompensation?
Oh, my God, this is so true. So, and I did. I was a kid and I went, it's the Bette Midler school of overcompensation. So I was very shy when I was little. And, you know, partly, yes, it was the abuse, but it was small for my age. And yay, I was smart. I got bumped up like half a grade. But when you're really, you're already small for your age and smaller than like everyone in your class. And then they're like, let's move her up a grade. So it's like, so I was very shy. I had everything going against me. And I was hearing about these actresses. And I was so short also that they weren't sure I was going to grow. I kind of got to 4'8" and kind of stayed there for a while. And my mother started saying things. Well, Nancy Walker, that actress, she's had a good career. And I'm like, oh, great, I'm Rhoda's mother. So that's her time, all these really short actresses. I'm 5'4" now, thank you, I grew it. But I started reading about these actresses, and I read that Bette Midler, you know, who's a huge star even back in the 70s, the Bette Midler, this brassy, incredible, wild lady with the onstage persona, that she was painfully, painfully shy all through, like, junior high, even to high school. And she sort of created this persona in public and on stage to sort of fight that. And then I read about that Nancy Walker, who played Rhoda's mom and many, many other great roles, she was always played these tough, tough characters. And she said, no, very shy, very retiring, kind of scared of people, kind of created this character. And all her characters were these women people were terrified of. And I started reading about these actresses who were shy but played the complete opposite, and people were, if anything, intimidated by. And I thought, well, here's a good idea. and so I called it the Bette Midler School of Overcompensation. And I started trying these tactics. I was really young, like I said, I was 11, 12 years old on the show. And I started, okay, what if when I walk into a room full of people and my immediate feeling is, you know, my stomach is doing backflips, I'm like, I should just leave. If I didn't leave, if I just marched up to someone, went, hi, and started talking to people, what if I was bold and wore bright colors and marched in and was like, yes, I'm here, hi, how are you? What would happen? I mean, what's the worst that could happen? I'm already feeling terrified, like I'm going to die. It's going to get worse? What? No. And I started doing that. And it was, people don't know. They don't know if you're shy or not unless you act like it. And it worked in this crazy way. It actually worked. And the other trick was my Auntie Marion, very shy woman, brilliant woman, very shy. She said, you know, people talk about themselves. You go to someone at a party and you just say, oh, and what do you do? She said, they'll go on for days. She said, oh, fascinating. Mm-hmm. Really, you don't say. She said, you eat your sandwich and you drink your tea and you nod your head and they do all the talking. And she was right. So you can go to the party. You can go to the job interview. You can do what you have to do if you're shy. You can fake it. And there are tricks you can use. And I have friends who are shy, and I encourage them because it's very painful. I hate being shy. But absolutely, I saw how a number of famous people did this. And it's a hell of a trick, and I highly recommend it.
You began doing stand-up at a very early age. How did that transform into the one-woman show that has taken the world by storm, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch?
Well, I was like, God, I'm 15, and my dad is managing a comedy group. He's managing all these people, and there was this comedy group called, of all things, the Village Idiots. Best name ever. And they were hilarious. In fact, Jan Fisher was in The Village Idiot. She wrote the movie The Lost Boys. Mm. Mark Gansell went on to work on the TV show Coach. And Peter Jurasik, the actor Peter Jurasik, is in Babylon 5 and dozens of movies. But these people were all in this group. They all went on to be very famous. And so I was hanging around with them, and we'd go to the clubs. And literally, like out of a movie, I was heckling a guy. A guy was doing sort of an audience participation thing. And I was 15, right? So I started giving him a hard time. And he said the famous last words, if you think this is so easy, you ought to try it. Well, that was like daring me to do something. So next thing I know, I'm meeting with the Village Idiots and saying, what do I need to do? And they wrote me a stand-up act. And so I was 15 and a half when I first got up on stage. And by the time I was 16, I was doing four nights a week, the Improv and the Comedy Stores, working all the time. And talk about overcoming shyness. So that really worked. And over the years, learning what worked, what didn't work, what audiences responded to, one of the things I saw is they all recognized me and they all wanted to talk about Little House. I would try to do stand-up and not talk about Little House. But as soon as I got to any point where I was talking to the audience, someone would say, you know, any questions? Yes, aren't you the girl who was on Little House on the Prairie? You had to open with it. There was no getting around. It's like, yes, it's me. And just like a... And I got a call to play New York. I'm fantastic. I've never played New York. And they said, but you need to do like an hour and a half. And I was like, good God, who's got an hour and a half? And they said, oh, yeah, and Joan Rivers works this room. She's coming in like after you, so you know, you probably need to swear more. And I was like, what? Okay. And so I wrote an entirely new show. I thought, I got to come up with something. So I did, it was all true stories. I said, well, wait, you know, a friend of mine said your act is great, but I like the stories you tell in the bar later. They're funnier. So I said, what if it was all true stories? It was all true stories from my life and all tied together with the running theme of, yes, people hate me. I was this bitch. And I did it. And I had a question and answer segment so the audience could participate. And they absolutely loved it. They went wild. And boy, the Q&A, I tell you, the Q&A segment is everybody's favorite thing. I love it. They love it. And I started doing that. And that was it. I said, well, this is the way to go. So I started doing that and adding to it and adding to it. And it became this, took on a life of its own. I started getting requests like mad. And then this guy, Patrick Louvatier, said, you know, we could do a French version of this. It would be kind of, I mean, you have to learn French. I have to do a whole adaptation, but it could be done. We could do a whole French version. I was like, you're insane. And then we did it. We completely did it. And we wound up doing the French version. And now I'm getting on a plane Sunday night to go to France and go do like six back-to-back shows.
That is wonderful. And did I see you're doing a radio show as well?
I know, like I don't have enough to do, right? So my friend said, why don't you have a show, a podcast, radio show? And there's a couple of stations in town that kind of do all the celebrity radio shows. All my friends were on them. And I'd been interviewed on most of them. And I talked to them. And over at UBN, UBN Go, they said, yes, come on. And so every Tuesday at 5 o'clock is the Allison Arngrim Show. And I interview a lot of celebrities, many of whom are friends of mine. And I find interesting authors and really cool people. Or as I say, it's Allison Arngrim Show, where we talk about the things that make you feel good. And, you know, for instance, Michael Learned, who was on the Waltons. Yes, it had lots of people from Little House on the Prairie. And the shows that made you feel good. Oh, Anson Williams from Happy Days. All these really cool people. But people who are also doing something now. Because, like, Anson Williams, for example, now, he was on Happy Days. He was Foxy. We loved him.
And he's an inventor now, right?
Yes. Do you know his uncle was Dr. Heimlich of the Heimlich.
Right. But he was on with us a couple of months ago talk about that.
The drops, I have two of them in my purse right now, the little tubes, alert drops. They're the greatest thing. And it's lemon. It's citric acid. It's the lemon juice concentrate. So it's not going to hurt you. It's no caffeine, no drugs. And it works. You spray it on your tongue, and it's kind of like slapping yourself in the face a little bit. If you're driving, and as he said, and Heimlich said, drowsy driving is extremely dangerous. The statistics are just crazy, the number of people who die from drowsy driving. If you're driving and you need to stop and you're thinking, I got to stop, I got to go home, I got to sleep, I got to get coffee, stop for a moment and spray these drops on your tongue, and you're good. You'll get home. And then because it's not speed, you'll be able to go to bed. but it's amazing. And he's doing this, and he put that out there. And I mean, how many lives is he saving with these things? And I have to say, they are also really good for jet lag.
Ah, perfect.
You get off the plane, and of course me, flying 10 and a half hours, right? And the jet lag always hits about the time you need to get your bags. And the jet lag's and you're like, but I need to be alert for a couple of more hours. I got to get a train. I got to get to the hotel. I can't fall asleep yet. And boom, alert drops. And it's perfect because then it kills enough of the jet lag. You're awake enough to get to the hotel, and then you can sleep.
Well, Allison, it is an absolute delight to talk with you. I loved your book. We wish you continued success. And again, happy birthday. Have a wonderful trip to France.
Thank you so much.
We hope you'll come back and visit with us again sometime.
I'd love to. Now, you're in Maine, right?
We are indeed, yes.
Okay, hi. I've been like once. I went to Algonquin. It was lovely, and I have friends from Maine, so yay, shout out. I'm in France, and then I'm in Fayetteville, Arkansas, the end of February, the 29th and 1st of March.
They're a lot alike. You won't be able to tell the difference.
What?
France and Fayetteville. It's like the same place, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, Fayetteville, Arkansas. I'm hearing that it's a very swinging place, actually. But yeah, it's so crazy. This is what I do. I'm like, oh, I'm in Berlin, and then I'm in Alabama. So kind of like all over the place. But yes, I'm going from Paris to Fayetteville. That's my schedule, seriously.
It's all about the journey. Allison, thank you again so much for visiting with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You bet. Bye-bye now. Allison Arngrim here on Downtown.